Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last month, the Rancho Feeding Corporation, a massive slaughterhouse in Petaluma, California, recalled 8.7 million pounds of diseased beef found in more than 1,000 grocery chains, including Kroger, Food for Less, and Walmart. The U.S. Department of Agriculture said the slaughterhouse processed and sold, quote, diseased and unsound animals without a full federal inspection in 30 states. According to Stephanie Larson, the livestock and range advisor at the University of California's Cooperative Extension System, about 25% of Rancho's customers were niche market operations, many of which raised grass-fed and organic beef. And the other 75% of the company's business was meat destined for burgers, tacos, chili, and other processed foods for supermarkets and restaurants. And then earlier this month, the Humane Society conducted an undercover expose of the Iron Maiden Hog Farm in Owensboro, Kentucky. It found that more than 900 piglets died from a diarrheal disease over a two-day period. The animals' intestines were ground up and fed back to their mothers, a practice prohibited by state law. But according to the Humane Society, this practice appears to be fairly widespread within the industrial sector of the pig industry. This is just one of several videos and exposés that reveal widespread animal abuse. So why don't we see more changes in this industry after so many exposés and meat recalls? Today's guest, David Simon, says the meat and dairy industry spend more than $100 million a year paying lobbyists to protect and insulate the industry and lower their costs of doing business. In his new book, Meatonomics, The Bizarre Economics of Meat and Dairy, David Simon explores many angles of the meat and dairy industries, the role the federal government plays in promoting meat culture in the U.S. He says, quote, few Americans are aware of the realities of Meatonomics, the economic system that supports our nation's supply of animal food. Yet the peculiar economic forces powering our food system influence us in ways few imagine and nudge us to behave in ways we normally wouldn't, end quote. David Simon is a lawyer and advocate for sustainable consumption. He works as a general counsel for a healthcare company and serves on the board of the APRL Fund, a nonprofit dedicated to protecting animals. And David joins me in studio. Hi, David. Thanks for coming in.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So I want to start off by talking about where you got the idea for this book. And it grew out of an exchange, an email exchange you had a number of years ago with a dean of a prominent law school. And it had to do with the fact that animals really don't have protection in this country. And you didn't even know that at the time.
I didn't know that, and I was surprised to learn it. I sent an email out to several people, including this guy who was my friend, and the email included a link to some images at factory farms, and I asked people what they thought about it, and this particular gentleman, dean of a law school, wrote back and said these images were disturbing and distressing, but as far as he was concerned, they were illegal, and that meant that they were an exception or an anomaly. And at the time, I didn't know how to respond to that. I didn't know if that was true or not. But when I started to do the research, I found that actually he's wrong. All of the images, generally most of the images that we see coming out of factory farms that show abuse of animals are typically legal. It is typically legal to do almost anything to a farmed animal. Farmed animals have essentially no rights to be free from inhumane or cruel treatment whatsoever in this country.
We're seeing so many videos come out from Mercy for Animals, the Humane Society. What would you say about the recent one at the Iron Maiden Hog Farm in Owensboro, Kentucky? 900 baby pigs died from a diarrheal disease, and then their intestines were ground up and fed back to their moms. Now, according to the Humane Society, this is illegal.
Yeah, that's illegal for food safety reasons. It's not necessarily illegal for cruelty reasons. Now there are certainly a wide range of food safety laws that regulate how animals can be processed for food. For example, downer cows or cows that are unable to walk of their own volition are typically not supposed to be slaughtered and processed. We see that sometimes too, but. So in this instance, the reason that's illegal is that you're simply not supposed to feed diseased animal parts back to animals that you're going to be processing for food, and that's a food safety issue.
Well, and this raises questions about regulation and inspectors. I mean, what does that look like in the year 2014?
The USDA is dramatically understaffed for its inspection needs. In this country, we process something like 30 million animals every single day, and we have something like 7,000 meat inspectors to inspect that enormous number of animals, and they simply can't be everywhere at every moment, and they can't see everything. And this actually argues in favor of supporting the sort of undercover investigations that like you mentioned, the HSUS investigation of this hog farm, that actually produce this kind of information that the inspections typically don't.
30 million animals a day just in the United States?
Yes. And that's only land animals. If you add marine animals, you essentially triple that number.
And so, okay, so we'll talk about the major players, but I wanted to also talk about this slaughterhouse up in Petaluma, a massive slaughterhouse. They recalled almost 9 million pounds of diseased beef, the Rancho Feeding Corporation. They're selling meat to 30 different states. And what's really interesting about this slaughterhouse is they are slaughtering all kinds of animals, the sort of grass-fed organic animals, and then the animals that are also sold to Walmart. And do you think the public realizes that maybe the cow that they think is being treated nice on that farm is slaughtered at the same farm that the animal that's sent to Walmart?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, there's a significant myth surrounding the idea of humanely raised animals, including the idea that grass-fed cattle are humanely treated, or for that matter, that they're better for the environment. We see that grass-fed animals produce much more methane than animals that are raised on a feedlot, for one example. And methane is 21 times more effective than carbon dioxide at trapping heat in our atmosphere. But we also see that with respect to so-called humanely raised animals, like grass-fed, cage-free animals, there are really no federal standards for what that means. Mm. And these animals can be pretty much treated in any way that is expedient and that saves the producer's money.
So 7,000 inspectors, 30 million animals slaughtered a day, land animals. Is there a difference between the organic grass-fed farms and the non? I mean, are there more inspectors on a farm? Or how do the inspectors decide where to go and how to spend their time?
Well, first of all, there are several stages in the life of a cow that's destined for slaughter. There's the stage at which they're raised for production, but then there's a stage at which they're sent to the slaughterhouse. And most organically raised animals end up in the same slaughterhouses as inorganically raised. And that's where they're challenged by this sort of shortage of inspectors. And it's going to be the same problem for organic or inorganic. And here's another just sort of example that I'll throw out there. Organic chickens were found in a recent study by Consumer Reports to have significantly more fecal matter in them than the inorganic chickens, completely inexplicably. So there's very little argument to suggest that when it comes to animal foods, organic is noticeably superior to inorganic.
What explains that? The fecal matter with the organic chickens?
I don't know. There's no explanation, and it's just sort of a curious anomaly.
We're speaking with David Simon, author of the new book, Meatonomics, How the Rigged Economics of Meat and Dairy Make You Consume Too Much. So it seems like these videos are coming out on a regular basis, these undercover videos. We're hearing about recalls on a regular basis. Why aren't we seeing any changes? Why isn't the USDA doing anything to increase the amount of inspections? Is it because the industry has so much influence in D.C.?
Yeah, you know, economists refer to this concept of regulatory capture that says that industry will seek out regulatory agencies for the purpose of protecting them. And so what we find in the case of the USDA and the FDA, both of whom have responsibility for regulatory action with respect to animal foods, is that industry has captured these agencies. The USDA has a dramatic conflict of interest because on the one hand, its mission is to promote food safety for Americans and to give us nutritional guidelines. But on the other hand, its mission is to promote the sale of animal foods. And it's very challenged to accomplish both of these missions at the same time because they're often diametrically opposed.
Do we see any changes after a massive recall like we're seeing in Petaluma of 9 million pounds of diseased beef sold in 30 states?
Typically, what we might expect to see is that Congress would have a subcommittee of Congress would have a hearing on it. Somebody from the USDA would have to go testify. Probably somebody from the Meat Inspectors Union would go testify, and maybe there would be a little pressure to up the level of inspections in the future. But no, we will likely not see any. Dramatic institutional changes as a result.
Let's talk about this industry. As you pointed out in your book, we talk a lot about oil subsidies. We talk about, the gun industry, all of these industries that have a lot of influence, but you don't really hear many people talk about the meat and dairy industry. This is a $251 billion industry. Who are the major players?
Well, we've got big multinational companies like Cargill, Tyson, Smithfield Foods, who produces pork, and some people may know that they were just bought by a Chinese company. And these are major public corporations, multinational. They go far beyond sort of the traditional notion of the small farmer that many people have in about the United States. The small farmers have simply been consolidated, driven out of business, and most animal food production today is done by factory farms with huge presences.
How much of it? Because there's a big movement in, especially in the Bay Area, Northern California, the grass-fed organic movement for animals. How much of it is grass-fed and organic?
A tiny, tiny portion. The conventional wisdom says that 99% of the animal foods that we eat today comes from factory farms. We have 19,000 factory farms in this country, and we have only 300 farms that practice ecological rotation. So if anyone is familiar with Michael Pollan's book, Omnivore's Dilemma, he talks about Polyface Farm that does eco-rotation. It's a statistically tiny number. It's about 0.1% of the total meat production. So,
what is eco-rotation?
Eco-rotation refers to the idea that you have a fairly large amount of pasture land, and you move your animals around the pasture land so that chickens move in advance of chickens move after the cattle. The cattle move, and when they leave manure, the manure cultivates worms and other protein matter that the chickens eat. The chickens follow, and this whole sort of process moves around the farm, and it's supposed to be about as environmentally friendly a way to raise animals as there is.
So we're talking about the big players in the meat and dairy industries, and they spend about $100 million on lobbying a year?
More, as much as $130
million.
And we can't track all of that because that's just the money that's publicly disclosed spending by industry groups. There are additional funds that are spent by the individual players like Tyson and Cargill.
And are they giving to Democrats and Republicans equally?
My guess is probably maybe a little more to Republicans, but yeah.
And what are they getting in return? We're seeing across the country these ag gag laws, which would make it illegal for activists to get undercover video. And this is taking the country by storm.
That's one example of many ways that these lobbying organizations are getting big bang for their buck. Ag gag laws make it illegal to conduct an undercover investigation at a factory farm. We now have them in 7 states, and producers are very persistent about trying to get them passed. We're only in the 7th or 8th week of the year, and already 4 ag gag bills have been introduced in states in this country. Last year, 20 bills were introduced. Luckily, they were all defeated. But there's this constant persistence to try to get these bills passed.
I'm speaking with David Robinson Simon about his new book, Meatonomics, How the Rigged Economics of Meat and Dairy Make You Consume Too Much. This is a $251 billion industry, and we'll talk about how the government also helps this industry and funds marketing and advertising. He says that because of all of the financial help from the government, that's why people eat so much meat. The average American, it's kind of hard to believe, but eats 200 pounds of meat a year. So what questions do you have about this industry? If you work in this industry, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about how it functions and the subsidies that it gets from the U.S. government? And what questions do you have about the economics of meat? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. Also, if you've seen some of these undercover exposés, what's your response? Do they change your diet and how you think about the meat industry? And if you're familiar with this recall at the Rancho Feeding Corporation in Petaluma, we'd also love to hear from you. Let's go first to Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thank you so much for doing this program. You know that this is a heartfelt subject of mine. What I was going to ask or bring up is that in Jonathan Safran Foer's book, Eating Animals, he discussed how, and I don't know if his actions preceded the ag-gag laws or not, but when he was trying to get into a factory farm of sorts, it was all locked and gated, and he was just commenting on that it couldn't be gated to keep the animals out because they couldn't get up and turn the knob to open the door, that it was largely David Safran Foer's position that they were locked to keep people like him out. And what I don't know, and maybe David Simon does, is if his discovery of that and writing it in the book preceded the ag-gag laws or anteceded it, or just dovetailed, because I was also going to bring up the ag-gag laws, but you beat me to it.
Well, that's a great question. Factory farmers have a tremendous incentive not to let the public see what goes on in factory farms. In fact, there's a great quote by Paul McCartney who said that if slaughterhouses had glass walls, we would all be vegetarians. And this idea of keeping people out of factory farms is an antecedent to ag-gag laws. The ag-gag laws add teeth to that, but it's always been very difficult to get into or to even see from a distance what goes on at factory farms, because the farmers know that if people see those conditions, they simply will stop supporting that industry.
And what is the status of where ag-gag laws have passed? What happens to activists that gather video?
It's another great question. There are really two components to this question. The activists themselves, the people who go in and do these investigations, they typically feel very strongly about what they're doing. They don't mind getting arrested. They don't mind going to jail. And they're happy to do that. The problem is the organizations that employ these activists, like Mercy for Animals and Compassion Over Killing, they cannot afford to have their employees arrested and convicted of a crime, because in the United States, at the federal level, we have what's called the Racketeer and Influenced Corrupt Organizations Act, or RICO. And under RICO, if an organization is convicted of two crimes, that's considered a pattern of racketeering activity. So I was on a panel a couple weeks ago in L.A. with lawyers from Mercy for Animals and Compassion Over Killing. They said, we simply cannot go into a state that has an ag-gag law and do an undercover investigation, period. So that rules out Iowa, North Dakota, Missouri, Utah, Kansas, Montana. Simply, it won't happen. And individual activists don't have the resources. They don't have the camera equipment, the technology to do this themselves. So we can pretty much assume that in all of those states, until those laws get changed at the legislative level or reversed in the courts, we will simply not see any undercover investigations emerging.
And these ag-gag bills and their supporters have close ties to the American Legislative Exchange Council.
They do. The American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, is an organization that was founded in the 70s, and its mission is to incubate conservative legislation that is business friendly, and to spread this around the country. And each year they produce about 1,000 bills that are introduced at the state legislative level, and about 200 of those pass. These are routinely pro-business, and they're things like bills that reduce damages for asbestos lawsuits, product liability suits. One of their recent egregious accomplishments was passing in 37 states voter identification laws that disproportionately affect minorities.
And an ag bill just advanced in Idaho in the Senate, and there's going to be some protests there to try to get the governor not to sign it, but he says he's going to.
Oh, sorry to hear that. A number of my colleagues who are attorneys are challenging these bills. There's a challenge right now in Utah. I'm hoping that we'll be able to overturn these as unconstitutional, because they affect free speech. They affect transparency.
Thank you again for calling in, Ruthann. Let's go next to Alex in Oakland. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Rose. It's Alec, unfortunately.
Oh, sorry. Hi, Alec. Good timing.
All right. We have a small farm, and this gets to the question he was saying was inexplicable, that the organic chickens have fecal matter just as much as the other ones. That's probably because they send them to a slaughterhouse that uses a mechanical eviscerator, We process each of our chickens by hand so you can see exactly what's going on. The mechanical eviscerators just throw everything all over the place. And that's where the problem comes up.
Huh. So mechanical eviscerators are widespread, and how...
It's a machine that you throw the chicken in, and it just slices and dices, but everything, you know, gets mixed all over the place.
Right. And then how...
Whereas if you're doing it by hand...
How common is it for small farms to do it by hand? Do you know?
Well, you know, we've got like 40 chickens, so we're really small.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them are laying hens. We only process maybe 50 chickens a year, if that. So probably very uncommon.
And Alec,
we have a friend, and she waits till she gets 25, and she sends them to a slaughterhouse.
I would guess that it's much more expensive to do this by hand as well, and that would affect the profitability of those chickens when you sell them.
Is that right, Alec? Oh, sorry. We lost him. Well, if you're a small farmer, we'd love to hear from you because these questions are really important and interesting. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we have time for a few more questions before we go to break. Let's hear from Michael in Santa Cruz. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
My question was around the comment that organic raised meat is no different than the factory farm meat. I often hear this, but my experience with moving on to a small family-owned organic farm 5 years ago, where we rotate no more than 4 or 5 cattle through 20 acres of pasture, is that it's had a huge, huge impact on my health. My cholesterol is down absolutely dramatically. They wanted to put me on blood medication. I was running around 300. I'm now down to like 110. I'm eating more meat. I'm eating homegrown food, and I think it's had a dramatic effect on my health, and it's made me very suspicious of the commercially raised beef. And this thing I hear all the time that, no, nutritionally there's no difference between the pasture-raised, organically raised beef and the factory farm beef. So I'm curious about why that is. Am I imagining things?
Well, you know, I cite in my book a study that the British government released several years ago in which they compare the nutritional effects of organic and inorganic and find that they are the same. Now, I think it's great that you're finding better results from organic meat. It may be that different people's bodies respond differently, but the clinical evidence that's been published and that's been done sort of at the statistically significant level does show that there's not a big difference. And from an environmental perspective, one of the things that we're often interested in is, are these practices sustainable? And organic versus inorganic often presents sort of different equations based on the animal. For cattle, for instance, the math that I came up with in the book shows that it's the effect is roughly the same to raise them organically versus inorganically. Whereas for pigs, it's much more eco-friendly to raise them organically.
Have there been a number of studies looking at exactly what Michael brought up?
Yes.
The differences between organic and non-organic animals?
Yes, people are quite curious about this, and there are several published studies out there.
All right, well, thank you for calling, Michael. We're speaking today with David Robinson-Simon about his new book, Meatonomics, How the Rigged Economics of Meat and Dairy Make You Consume Too Much. And after the break, we will talk about the U.S. government's role in this meat culture. And then also, we will talk about these checkoff programs that help the dairy and meat industry advertise and talk about things like protein. And if you have any questions about the meat and dairy industries, we'd love to hear from you. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call, a program that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling toll-free 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or you can post your comment or question at yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, from the World Service of the BBC, World Have Your Say, and following that at noon, it's Backstory. You're on KALW San Francisco, where the time is 10:30.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about whether the FCC is ready to defend the public interest in the new world of media and consolidation. We will talk about Comcast's $45 billion bid to merge with Time Warner and the future of the Internet. What does this mean for the public interest? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with David Simon about his book, Meatonomics, How the Rigged Economics of Meat and Dairy Make You Consume Too Much. David is a lawyer. He advocates for sustainable consumption, and he serves on the board of the APRL Fund, a nonprofit dedicated to protecting animals. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about how the meat and dairy industries work, it's a $251 billion industry. They spend $100 to $150 million a year paying lobbyists to protect the industry and lower their cost of doing business. We'll talk about why the cost of meat is so low, especially if you don't buy organic meat, it's really low. And if you work in this industry, we'd also love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And before we get to calls, I wanted to ask you about a program that, as you say, few Americans have never heard of. It's called checkoff programs. And thanks to these checkoff programs, we've got these slogans like beef, it's what's for dinner, milk, it does a body good, and pork, the other white meat. Tell us about these checkoff programs.
Yeah, these programs are incredible in terms of how effective they are, and yet most of us have never heard of them. We've heard of their slogans, like as you mentioned, beef, it's what's for dinner, milk, it does a body good. But the important thing to know about checkoff programs is that while they're ostensibly organized by private industry, the USDA has a very, very significant role in running these programs. The USDA appoints their leadership. It monitors their collection of funds, their spending of funds, and monitors their messaging. It can edit and veto their messaging. And for these reasons, in 2005, the United States Supreme Court held that when a checkoff program speaks, it speaks the message of the United States federal government. And one of the points that I make in the book is that that means that when you hear beef, it's what's for dinner, that is the federal government telling you to eat more beef. And I really question whether we need our government issuing messages like that.
Why would the government do that?
Because the USDA has this mission of expanding the market for animal foods and helping producers sell more goods. And Congress supports that mission by setting up checkoff programs for animal foods. We now have checkoff programs for beef, pork, dairy, both fluid and solid, lamb, and eggs.
You write that these programs provide funding of $557 million a year for animal food producers to promote their goods.
That's right. And if that sounds like a big number, the really big number is based on the data that the checkoff programs themselves release, we know that that $550 million yields about $4.6 billion in extra sales. That's about an 8-to-1 return on investment. That's just a huge, huge return on investment.
And you believe that because of these programs, for example, annual per capita consumption of milk in the United States has climbed 12% to 620 pounds since 1983. You think it's directly related?
The dairy checkoff program issued that statistic. They were proud of that their checkoff increased consumption by 12%. So I assume that that is the case.
What about subsidies? How much money does the meat and dairy industry get in subsidies every year?
I add that figure up to be about $38 billion per year. And to put that number in perspective, it's about four times the level at which we subsidize the oil industry in this country.
What explains that?
Well, one thing that explains that is that a lot of these subsidies are paid in roundabout ways that don't end up on our radar. The conventional wisdom is that subsidies to the animal food industry are only maybe $3 or $4 billion a year. But that conventional figure doesn't include things like crop subsidies and irrigation subsidies. We have to look at those because in this country, the majority of the crops that we raise go to feed animals who are raised for food. So in my figure, I've added in irrigation and crop subsidies at both the state and federal level, and that yields a much larger number than people are typically accustomed to seeing.
And most of this money goes to the large multinationals like ConAgra And Tyson.
That's right. 5% of the farming corporations get 90% of the subsidy money.
I'm still trying to figure out why the government is directly involved in promoting this industry.
Yeah, it's a challenging question. Abraham Lincoln established the USDA 150 years ago with the goal of helping rural Americans. And at the time, that meant the farming community. And the USDA has just continued to have this very strong mission to push animal foods. One of the things that makes me question this in particular is that the USDA knows, because it publishes the data, that in every sex and age demographic group in this country, Americans are already consuming more animal food products than the USDA itself recommends. So one of the troubling things is, if the USDA knows this, why do they continue to stand behind programs that promote it so aggressively?
And then with other industries, we also see the revolving door, right? So one day an executive works for ConAgra and the next day they're at the USDA.
That's right. We have a lot of people working in the USDA and in other regulatory agencies that come directly from industry. And in fact, the committee that establishes the dietary guidelines for Americans has a majority of industry participants on it. And that's something that should give people some pause as well.
And this is the food pyramid.
That's right.
David Simon is author of Meatonomics, How the Rigged Economics of Meat and Dairy Make You Consume Too Much. Do you think you're consuming too much? What are your thoughts on these checkoff programs and this industry overall, $251 billion industry that receives $38 billion in yearly subsidies? We've got full lines, but we'll have one open in a few minutes at 866-798-8255. Let's go to Grant in Santa Cruz. Hi, Grant.
Hi. Well, thank you so much, Rose, for another really excellent show and a great guest.
Thank you.
I guess it really brings to mind, and just the discussion up to this point, of we really need to significantly change the system of lobbyists and the corruptive influence of money in our whole political system, which maybe is, that's a huge undertaking, but it seems like in so many arenas it is so... I mean, our government is involved in corruptive practices and unhealthy practices due to that. my question actually was in regards to, I think the U.S. government is involved in this, but in the kind of framing and terminology of eco-terrorism. And I was also very interested in what... your guest might have to say about Temple Grandin, who did a lot around, I think there's a great film about her work to improve slaughterhouses and make them humane and humanitarian. That's probably more than enough.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So that's really two questions. Let me talk about eco-terrorism laws first. We have these so-called eco-terrorism laws today in 39 states. Thanks to ALEC, that group we discussed earlier, the American Legislative Exchange Coalition. And what these laws do is they provide enhanced criminal penalties for crimes that would otherwise be fairly innocuous, so that if somebody is engaged in vandalism or trespassing, if their target is an animal enterprise, like a factory farm, a grocery store, a restaurant, then they can be subject to dramatically heightened criminal penalties. Now, when I researched this book, I was very curious about why we need these anti-terrorism laws to be applied to, for example, animal activists. We don't actually have any significant cases of food terrorism in this country. The FBI has never had a food terrorism case on its list of major terrorism cases. This is essentially a scare tactic. There's a great book out called Green is the New Red that compares this this fear of environmentalism and animal activism to the communist scare that pervaded this country in the 50s.
And that's by Will Potter. We've had him on before.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah. Well, thank you again for calling in, Grant. Oh, any comments about Temple Grandin?
Well, I will say Temple Grandin is something of a controversial figure in the animal rights community, because on the one hand, I think many people think it is great that slaughterhouses are designed to be more humane. I think on the other hand, people would like to see fewer slaughterhouses in general.
All right. Thank you for calling. Let's go next to Larry in San Francisco. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Rose, and thank you for taking my call. I have a comment and a question for David. The comment is there seems to be in the press this tendency to talk about Rancho as a huge meat processing facility, and I'd love David to put that in perspective, the size of Rancho as compared to a Cargill facility or other Tyson facilities. And the second misconception that's being promoted in the press is that all almost 9 million pounds of the meat that was recalled was diseased. There's no proof that I've seen that the meat was diseased. It's very obscure as to what actually went on or didn't go on. So that was my comment, and I would hope that the press does a little more work into this.
What makes you say that you think the media is getting it wrong?
Well, I don't think Rancho is a huge operation. It's a small, you know, it's tiny compared to the facilities. A year's supply of Rancho meat is comparable, you know, my numbers aren't exact, but fairly close to a week's worth of production at some of these factories.
Well, thank you. But
my question is also, when we talk about ecoterrorism, there's no greater form than ecoterrorism than the pollution of our groundwater taking place by CAFO. And the government subsidizes companies not merely by promoting them through checkoff programs, but also ignoring their wrongdoings. Bobby Kennedy had a very good list of all the EPA lawsuits that were dropped under the last few administrations. So allowing these CAFOs to continue to pollute the groundwater, the soil, and the air. And I'd love David's comment on EPA action and the form of ecoterrorism taking place by Big Ag. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, as you note, the EPA has been about as effective as the USDA and the FDA in regulating animal agriculture. And, you know, as you point out, today, roughly one-third of U.S. groundwater sources are contaminated with animal waste. And in a study that was conducted a couple of years ago, over a three-year period, it was found that over 1,000 factory farms with manure lagoons experience leaks from those lagoons into our groundwater system. This is a terrible, unsustainable practice. Each year, these animals produce about 1 trillion pounds of waste. That's enough to fill the giant stadium in New York 250 times. And all of this waste has to go someplace. Mm-hmm. It doesn't just magically disappear. We have to find ways to deal with it. It always ends up in our water.
There was a film, I think it's called Vegucated, and their hog farms are predominant in what state?
North Carolina.
And they show that the feces from the hogs were actually coming out of some of the, when people were watering their lawns, it was coming out.
It's
really hard to believe that that's happening.
It's terrible. That also points to another factor, and that is that we have 19,000 factory farms in this country. If you are unfortunate enough to live near one, the studies show the value of your home has declined as a result.
He also had a question about, Grant had a question, I'm sorry, Larry had a question about the Rancho Feeding Corporations, the slaughterhouse in Petaluma. And as he said, like Mother Jones, for example, calls this a giant slaughterhouse, and it processes almost 9 million pounds of meat a year sent to grocery stores in 30 states. Is this small or is this big?
To me, that sounds pretty big, but I actually don't know the typical output of a typical slaughterhouse. It sounds like a lot of meat to me. You know, Larry asked another interesting question that I can address, and that is, is all that meat really diseased? The answer is we don't really know, but in a recall situation, you typically have to recall all of it. Another issue to think about is that when beef is ground and processed through grinders, the carcasses of many, many animals are mixed together. So even if only one animal in 1,000 has disease, once you pass it through that grinder and it mixes with the rest, you've got 1,000 contaminated carcasses, and they all have to be recalled.
We're talking about everything from Walmart hamburgers to Nestle Hot Pockets. So what happens, for example, in terms of the health effects, if you eat this contaminated meat? I mean, what? There's no knowing if something would happen to you tomorrow or 10 years down the road?
That's a great question. I'm not a doctor, and I don't know if any doctor would even know the answer to that. I wouldn't want to eat contaminated meat personally, and, you know.
Well, the USDA said it's, quote, unfit for human food.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again for calling, Larry. Let's go next to Carol in San Francisco. Hi, Carol. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose, and thank you again for such a wonderful program. I just wanted to tell you a story about my experience with going to a slaughterhouse. When I got married about 7 years ago, before I got married, I wasn't necessarily a vegetarian, but I didn't eat red meat. And when I did get married, I married a meat eater from Wisconsin. and so we decided that we would be very careful where we got our meat from. So we started getting our meat from Prather Ranch, which is kind of a boutique meat company at the Ferry Building. And they had said that you could go and visit their slaughterhouses if you wanted to. So I decided before we started eating any meat that I wanted to go and see that what their practices were. And supposedly they were able to do the Temple Grandin's philosophy of being kind to the slaughter, to the animals. And but more importantly, I just wanted to see if they would let me really in. And I did. I actually did. They were up in Shasta, north of Shasta, I think, over by Willits. They have 6 very large ranches. They only had slaughter days on Tuesdays and on, I think, Thursdays. And so I had to go up on a Tuesday, and I had to go early in the morning. And I actually watched when they corralled the cattle. There was only three or four or five cattle at that point that were actually going to be slaughtered. And I watched the whole process. It was very humane. They put them in some sort of cradle. They put them so they had to go up on top, and they were in this cradle, and then someone got up on a ladder, and I don't think it was a bullet, but it was some sort of stun gun that actually killed them very quickly. They went into the slaughterhouse. There was a lever that opened up this cradle, and they went right down into the slaughterhouse. I went right down to the slaughterhouse. I was led in. I stayed by the person that was the FDA inspector. I watched the FDA inspector go through the meat. Within literally, like 15 minutes, not even maybe that, everything was done. I was extremely impressed. And I'm thinking about actually, not eating any meat for ecological reasons just because of the methane problem with our,
Carol, sorry to cut you off, but we're almost out of time. Do you have a question for David?
I don't. I just wanted to tell you that story.
Okay. David, do you want to respond?
Yeah, I would respond to that quickly. And that's a nice story, and it's nice to know those animals are treated humanely. But we should also remember that the moment of slaughter is the only time in an animal's life when it is covered by or protected by federal law. And during all of the other moments of that animal's life, from the time that it is born through its transportation to that slaughterhouse, it is not protected by any or by virtually any anti-cruelty laws. So that, for example, animals are castrated or they have their testicles severed or crushed without any anesthetic. They have their tails chopped off. They're branded, and nobody would like to have a red-hot poker applied to their flesh. So there are many, many cruel practices that precede this moment of slaughter.
Does that happen on the organic grass-fed farms?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Carol. Let's go next to Mario in Salinas. Hi, Mario. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me. My main question was, you're talking about the economics making us consume more meat. How exactly does that go about? Is it like through the advertisements telling us, eat your meat, get your protein, drink your milk, get your calcium? How does that go about?
Well, that's a great question, and that's one of the main themes of the book. And I talk about a number of ways that's done, but let me just address one quickly, and that is what's called the externalization of costs. If I give my garbage to a garbage service and let them take it and dispose of it for me, I internalize my garbage collection costs. But if I drive over to a park at midnight and throw it on the ground, I externalize my garbage collection costs because I impose those costs on society. What I argue in the book is that animal food producers are externalizing their costs. They're, metaphorically speaking, dumping their garbage in our parks at midnight. And what that means is they offload the vast majority of their costs, their production costs, onto consumers and taxpayers, so that for every time McDonald's sells a Big Mac for, say, $5, there's $8 in additional externalized costs that are imposed on consumers. Because those prices are kept artificially low, which is to say that Big Mac should really cost $13, but instead it only costs $5. That causes people to buy a lot more Big Macs than they would otherwise.
I think they're even cheaper than that.
That was sort of an average price, $4.50 to $5.50.
How do they keep the costs so low? Because when you go to a fast food or you see fast food advertisements, the food's really pretty cheap.
It's incredibly cheap. Last I knew, McDonald's had a dollar menu with a double cheeseburger that was $1. In the last 75 years, if you look at the retail prices of animal foods on an inflation-adjusted basis, they have declined across the board. They literally defy gravity. The price of chicken is down 74% since 1935. You look at almost any other consumer good, and its price has gone up. In fact, that's how we define inflation. We take a basket of consumer goods and watch their prices over time. Animal food prices are completely resilient to the forces of inflation because of this massive externalization of costs, because producers routinely impose their costs on the rest of us and don't bear those costs themselves the way they should.
And you say that equates to about $414 billion a year?
That's right. And that's, for some people, that's a big number. To put that in perspective, that is about half of what the United States spends on Social Security each year, and it's about one quarter of Canada's gross domestic product.
How did you come up with that number?
That number consists of several components, including healthcare costs, subsidy costs, environmental damage, fishing damage, and what I refer to as cruelty costs. That is the dollar amount that Americans would likely be willing to pay to end cruel practices in factory farms, as determined by some actual live auctions that agricultural economists have conducted.
Where do you see this going? I just read an article about how meat consumption in China is just on the verge of exploding. And you mentioned that China recently bought one of these major producers. Which one was it again?
Smithfield Foods.
Smithfield Foods. Yeah. How will that change the way that citizens interact with a company like Smithfield Foods now that it's owned by a group in China, or what?
It's a Chinese animal food production corporation.
Yeah.
I think it's pause for some concern, because we already know that these groups have very little regulatory pressure to treat animals humanely. China is not known to be overly concerned with the humane treatment of animals. But you point to an even bigger problem, and that is that around the world, demand for animal foods is exploding. Here's an issue of sustainability. If, you know, Americans today consume more meat per capita than any other nation in the world, if and when the rest of the world catches up to us in terms of meat consumption, we will need two-thirds again as much land as we currently have on this planet in order to raise the animals to meet that demand. We have an incredible sustainability problem that's unfolding in real time.
Where do you see this going?
I see a dramatic need to reduce consumption in order to ensure that we don't ruin our planet, in order to satisfy this incredible demand.
What changes would you like to see? I mean, it's really interesting when you look at what's happening in California with our drought. You live in Southern California. I just read in the Chronicle that a lot of farmers are now feeding the cows grain because they don't have any grass to eat.
That's right. And, you know, Texas is another great example of a state that's been in drought for several years. Texas is the leading cattle producer in this country, producing about 14 million head of cattle each year. If the water required to produce those cattle was instead used to create a lake in Texas, the entire state of Texas would be covered by a one-foot lake, and I think that would probably end their drought. So that gives you some idea of how our priorities affect our climatological and local conditions.
Well, the fact is, people are eating meat, and there are some changes, but the meat consumption is on the rise. Given that reality, what changes would you like to see?
Well, I like to talk about tobacco as an example. In this country, we tax tobacco at about an average of 72%. And we have seen that has been very effective at reducing tobacco consumption over the years. We've gone from about 1 in 2 people smoking to about 1 in 5 people smoking over about 50 years. I would like to propose a meat tax. I suggest in the book a 50% federal excise tax on all foods that contain animal products that would be imposed at the retail point of sale. A tax like this, together with some of the other institutional changes that I suggest in my book, would have incredible, incredible benefits for this country. For example, we could save 172,000 human lives each year. We could save 26 billion animal lives each year. we could return to its native habitat almost 600,000 square miles of land that would no longer be needed to raise animals or the crops to feed them. And we could avoid emitting something like 3 trillion pounds of carbon equivalent emissions. And that would have the same effect as removing from service all motor vehicles and all motor vessels in this country.
Hmm. Well, we are seeing a lot of groups like the UN, for example, talk about the connection between our food choices and the environment.
We are. The UN has said people need to eat less meat and eat more plants. And we have 7 billion people on the planet today. We're expected to have 10 billion people in just a few decades. Unless we heed the UN's advice and change our diets, we're going to be in big trouble. People can certainly exercise an individual option to eat less meat. They can. Some people might want to go vegan. Some people might want to go vegetarian. The evidence suggests that even if you do go vegan one day a week, try a so-called meatless Monday, there are many benefits. You can reduce your risk of death by 11%. You can have the same effect as removing a car from the road for 3 months. And you can save 5 land animals from a fairly unpleasant life in a factory farm.
David Robinson Simon is author of Meatonomics, How the Rigged Economics of Meat and Dairy Make You Consume Too Much. He's a lawyer and advocate for sustainable consumption, and he serves on the board of the APRL Fund, a nonprofit dedicated to protecting animals. David, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Is the FCC ready to defend the public at a time when we're seeing so much consolidation? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about Comcast's $45 billion bid to merge with Time Warner and the future of the internet. The deal would combine the country's largest and second largest cable firms. So what does this mean for the public interest? Are we on the verge of new rules to protect citizens or continued consolidation? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.